time now for Inside the Huddle on WILO, hosted by Ken Hartman. This program will focus on area schools and all the sports they have to offer. Ken will speak with coaches and players across the region. Your participation is encouraged. Call now at 659-3338 to discuss local or statewide sports. Inside the Huddle is brought to you by Tony Theofanis, State Farm Insurance, and Susan Casper, State Farm Insurance in Frankfort. Now here's your host, Ken Hartman.
Good Saturday morning and welcome to Inside the Huddle, sponsored by your State Farm Insurance agents, Susan Casper and Tony Theofanis. I am your host, Ken Hartman. On today's show, we're going to be repeating an interview we did last week with human rights activist and pioneer for racial equality, Richard Lapchick. It was a great interview, and we're going to go ahead and replay it here in a few minutes for you. Then at 9:30, we're going to be talking with Frankfort State pole vault champion from 2018, Colton Crum, who's now at Notre Dame. Colton's going to be in the studio with us, and we're going to have a little discussion with him. That's coming up at 9:30 this morning. But before we get that far, we need to talk about some things that took place yesterday, and some things I think are very interesting with some of the more important things that are going on right now that people are trying to get through. One of those is Major League Baseball, which seems to be tripping all over itself and also self-destructing itself. And then this happened yesterday, is that all Major League Baseball training camps will temporarily close. That's a source close to ESPN after multiple teams reported positive coronavirus tests on Friday. Spring training facilities in Florida and Arizona will undergo a deep cleaning, and players will need to test negative before they can return, according to multiple reports. News is first reported by USA Today, Sports yesterday. Earlier on Friday, the Philadelphia Phillies, Toronto Blue Jays, San Francisco Giants, and Texas Rangers all announced they'd be shutting down their facilities until further notice. The Phillies closed their spring training facility in Clearwater, Florida, after five players and three staff members tested positive. Blue Jays shuttered their site in Dunedin, Florida, about 5 miles from the Phillies camp, after a player showed symptoms consistent with the virus. Giants facility in Scottsdale, Arizona, was closed after one person who had been to the site and one family member exhibited symptoms on Thursday, and the Rangers shut down their camp in Surprise, Arizona, saying no players or staff has tested positive, but they wanted to expand COVID-19 testing protocols. And that's on the heels of the fact that players didn't like the 70-game proposal for Major League Baseball. And so right now we're sitting with that. If we're going to play 60 or 70, they're getting closer, I think, to the salary, but, you know, who in the world knows right now. And then we deal with college football. And this is something, I have questions all along. It'd be very difficult to be playing football, I don't care what level, high school, college, or pro this year. But here's some things to let you just chew on for a little bit. This came out yesterday. Of the 28 positive coronavirus tests conducted on Clemson student athletes and staff since their return to campus 2 weeks ago, 23 belonged to football players, a source said on Friday. School announced its total number of 315 tests and 28 positive in a statement following a second round of tests, but did not break down the number by sport. The source of the school said last week's round of tests, 21 football players tested positive, as did two members of the football staff, which is not limited to coaches. Last week, the school said two other football players, as well as men's basketball player, tested positive during the school's initial run of 169 tests. The state of South Carolina on Friday reported its highest number of total positive tests. It's 1,081 people, and the highest percentage of possible positive tests to date. The rate of positive tests at Clemson this month is nearly double the national averages. So that's going on at Clemson. Also yesterday, this came out that Texas says it has 13 football players that have confirmed for positive coronavirus tests or are presumed positive, according to Alan Harden, who is the school's senior associate athletic director for sports medicine and performance. Texas says all 13 players are now self-isolating, and 10 more identified through the contact tracing are in self-quarantine but are asymptomatic at this time. And he also says, in addition, four players have tested positive for the COVID-19 antibody. Centers for Disease Control says it does not know if any antibodies can prevent a second infection, or if so, for how long that might last. So that's just some of the things that are coming up. So we're having problems with college football on the coronavirus side, as well as Major League Baseball. So we'll just see what happens. That's the latest we have on that right now. As we said, we're going to rerun last week's interview we did with Richard Lapchick, who is a human rights activist and pioneer for for racial equality. So here's that interview right now. Joined now by Richard Lapchick, who is a the human rights activist, pioneer for racial equality, expert on sports issues, scholar and author. He's also the president for the Institute of Sports and Social Justice, chairman of the DeVos Sports Business Management Program at the University of Central Florida, and director of the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sports. Did I leave out anything?
No, made me tired listening.
That's true. First of all, since we're going to be talking about a report card that you guys put out on racial and gender for 2019 here, how did you get involved in this to start with?
I'm going to have to go way back because it started way back.
That's all right. It's okay.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm fine. We're here.
Okay. When I was 5 years old, I looked outside my bedroom window and saw my father's image swinging from a tree with people under the tree picketing. And for several years after that, I'd pick up the extension phone in our house, my dad not knowing I was listening, and it was racial epithet after racial epithet being hurled at him. And as a 5-, 6-, and 7-year-old, I didn't really know what that meant, except a lot of people didn't like my best friend in the world. And I would later realized that as the coach of the New York Knicks, he had signed the first African-American player in the history of the NBA, and there were a lot of people who weren't happy about that. He was also a triple inductee into the Basketball Hall of Fame, and everybody told me I'd play in the NBA, which I loved that idea, so I pursued it pretty hard. I was one of the tallest players in the New York City area in the 8th grade and was heavily recruited and did not go to, but became friends with the coach of a school called Power Memorial High School. He invited me to his startup basketball camp in 1961, and there were five other white guys and a black guy there. And one of the white guys was hurling the N-word at the black guy for the first 3 days, and I finally challenged him. He knocked me out cold. The black guy's name at the time was Lou Alcindor, became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Right.
And a lifelong friendship began that when Kareem's statue was unveiled at the Staples Center, he asked me to speak at it. When he went to the White House to get the Presidential Medal of Freedom, he invited me to be his guest. He flew here to Orlando to be with me when I was scheduled to have surgery, so it's been a rich, long friendship. But as a 15-year-old white kid from an almost all-white community, I suddenly had a young, urban African-American lens with which to see what racism was doing in America, and I decided then, as a 15-year-old, I was going to spend my life working on the issue of race, and I didn't know what that would mean at that point, but I knew I wanted to do that. I went and got a PhD in international race relations, did my doctoral dissertation on how South Africa used sport as part of its foreign policy and the international response to it during the apartheid era, and compared it to how the Nazis had done that in the 30s. It got published as a book. I ended up being asked to speak a lot on it. I founded the sports boycott of South Africa, and in 1978, the first South African team was coming to the United States. It was a Davis Cup team that was going to play in Nashville, Tennessee, and I went down there to try to build a protest and get the matches canceled. The African government had asked me to announce that they would boycott the LA Olympics in 1984 if this team was allowed to come. So when we held a press conference on Monday, all three networks were there. Dick Schaap, who was a correspondent for NBC Nightly News at the time, came up to me after the press conference before I spoke to the students and said the financial backers had pulled out. Looked like the matches were going to be canceled. I felt, as I flew home to Virginia that night, that maybe I had done something worthwhile for the first time in my life. The next night I was working late in my university office. The office was in the library, which closed at 10:30. At 10:45, there was a knock on the door. I opened the door expecting it to be the campus security just doing a routine check because they saw a light on. But instead it was two men wearing stocking masks who proceeded to cause liver damage, kidney damage, a hernia, concussion, carved the N-word in my stomach with a pair of office scissors. Laying in the hospital that night, I realized that if people had gone to the length they had done to try to stop my dad 28 years before and to the length they went that night to try to stop me, that they must have thought we were having an impact on racism. So I decided that I would spend the rest of my life using the sports platform to address issues of racial justice as well as other social justice issues. And I have done that.
When you look at what's going on currently, does that take you back a few years, or do you think we're getting there, or where do you think we're at with all of this?
I think that this is different. This is a gut feeling. I think that, you know, I'm sure what you're referring to is not only what happened to me and my dad, but, mm-hmm. you know, growing up in the civil rights era and watching everything that had happened, particularly in the South during that era, and then in various incidents throughout my life, and seeing people demonstrate and express their anger after each one of them, but never seeing it really sustained so that change, real change came about. But now I feel that a combination of things is making this different. I think Generation Z and the millennials are a more passionate, compassionate, and social justice conscious generation. On top of that, they have access to smartphones, which have changed the nature of what we see. I mean, when I was growing up in the civil rights era, I would see still photographs in newspapers about some of the horrific acts that took place. But now when you see literally a man murdered in front of your eyes and watch the life literally go out of him, it's a different kind of feeling. So they can capture all those moments, and they're not debatable once they're on film. They also have social media at their access that they can spread the word and organize much more effectively and more quickly. And I think a third factor, and your interest in the world of sports, and I'm from the world of sports, is the fact that we now have a significant number of athletes who have become activists on social justice issues. 5 years ago, there wasn't anybody in the world of sport that was doing that. Yesterday, 1,400 athletes and people from the world of sports signed a letter to Congress demanding action on certain political issues involving racial justice. And I think the combination of those things make it a different time and make me feel that we might be able to sustain this and bring about some meaningful changes that are being openly discussed now.
How much are the white participation by the white athletes, especially the ones who have some names, plus the fact that the Confederate flag is now being banned by NASCAR, and that's something I never thought I'd see the end of. How much does that make a difference in this case?
Well, I think that not only is it white athletes involved, but when you look at photographs and film of the demonstrations themselves, they're extremely diverse. And the world of sport itself is the most diverse workplace that we have in America, with the possible exception of the military. And I think having those forces united of different racial groups is really important. I think I see for the first time and hear for the first time white people listening to what black people are saying and trying to absorb the pain that they have gone through by and large as a group of people. When I was attacked in 1978, a number of people said to me, well, now you understand what it feels like to be black. And I said, I really don't, because I can walk away from the fight anytime and rejoin the white middle class and never face discrimination again. But if you're somebody who's black or a person of color, you can't just walk away. You are black or a person of color and face those forms of discrimination.
In your mind, how far away are we from basically eliminating this issue?
Well, as I said earlier, I was very involved in the anti-apartheid movement, and I remember that South Africans in particular thought that once Nelson Mandela became president in 1994, that everything would get better right away. They expected equal education, housing, medical services, but they forgot that this took 200-plus years to create that system of oppression, so it couldn't happen instantly. I think it's not going to happen instantly in the United States, and I think we're going to see pieces of it happen all around the country. There's so much talk about police reform and the policing issue right now, but it's, you know, the bottom line for us in America to understand is that the Forbes list of 100 wealthiest Americans have an aggregate wealth greater than all 42 million African Americans combined. That's a lot to overcome, and it's going to have to be addressed systematically and over a substantial period of time.
When you did the 2019 College Race and Gender Report Card, it showed some gains, but not as much as I'm sure you'd like to have seen. So how far away are we from getting to the point where you will be somewhat satisfied with what the report card tells you?
Well, we can't have 57% of our Division I football players being African American and 10% of our head coaches being African American. In basketball, we have a similar percentage of African American student athletes, and we have 24% of the coaches are African American. In 2006, 24% of the coaches were African American. We are exactly where we were 14 years ago. So I'm a long way from being satisfied. We're certainly what we base the grade on is the percentage of whatever the occupation is equal to the percentage of the people in the population. We don't do it on based on the percentage of people playing the sport, because that would, I think, be an almost impossible goal to reach. But based on the population, if they're proportional, I think that would be good. And there are in the league offices, they've met that in professional sport at the NCAA headquarters, they've met that. So there are definitely areas where it's improved. But on a gender basis, when you look at probably the most startling statistic for me in that report is that 48 years after the passage of Title IX, calling for equal opportunity for women and girls in sport, among other areas, 60% of all the head coaches across all three divisions are men. Mm-hmm. 50% of all assistant coaches of women's teams are men.
Right.
I speak a lot on college campuses, and I ask athletic directors, would you hire a woman to coach a men's team? And they look at me like, I heard you were crazy, Lapchick, but I didn't think you were that crazy. Yet 60% of the women's teams are
right. Men. I thought in this article I've got here that I got off of ESPN, and in this one paragraph, I think it says it all. It says, in a graduate program at UCF where I'm a professor, any grade below a B is considered not passing. A student is not allowed one C to be able to remain in the program. Two of the three grades for college sports were below a B. But that's an improvement, though, wasn't it?
It was a very slight improvement, yes. They went, I think, from 77% overall to about 78.3% or something in that area. It kept them as a C+, but it was an improvement on the racial grade, for sure.
Basically, overall, what we're saying is that basically everybody, with the exception of the NCAA, is moving slowly forward. Nobody else is even making strides, are they?
The colleges and universities are very far behind.
And the pro sports are just about as far behind, aren't they?
The NBA and WNBA do very well. Major League Soccer does pretty well. The NFL and Major League Baseball are very far behind, particularly in the coaching and general manager ranks.
Okay. What is it going to take, in your mind, for us to get this taken care of? And, it's definitely not going to be an overnight fix, though, is it?
It's not going to be overnight. And I think that, we've got things like the Rooney Rule in place that are starts. But I think the thing that's going to make a difference now is if athletes raise their voice about this issue as they're raising it about other issues in society, I think we'll see change come about much quicker. I think if athletes, and we say in the world of sports, even at the highest levels, that diversity is a business imperative, that's good for business. Well, on a team, if the African-American players believe that the search processes, even if they choose a white guy in the end, because that's certainly possible, but as long as they see that the search process was open, there were people who had the abilities to do the job from all racial groups, or depending on what the job is, including genders, then they're going to feel more comfortable with the organization. They're going to play harder for the owner if they believe the owner's fair.
What do you think sports are going to look like here in the next few years? And this includes with the coronavirus and all the stuff that's happened with that. How do you envision what the sports world may look like? And if you want to take a little bit of the academic world with it, please be my guest.
Well, if you mean in the short term, it's going to obviously look very different. I live in Orlando. We've got Major League Soccer and the NBA playing out this entire season at Disney's Wide World of Sports, which was designed essentially for high-profile youth to play sports. I think it's a good compromise because they want to protect the players. Do we have a vaccine that protects people in the future? I think that's going to be a determining factor. Are we going to ever return to sport as it is normally played with fans, lots of fans in the stands, and as we remember it not that long ago? But that aside, I think we're going to see athletes continue to be active. I think you're going to see other leagues realize that the NBA has an enviable position because the players and the teams and the league office seem to trust each other and believe in each other. And I think as that happens, and if that happens in the other sport, that it'll be a much more less cantankerous relationship between players and owners and the teams. And if you know, all the leagues now have said our players can protest. We're not going to take sanctions against them.
Mm-hmm.
That's an important first step for the players believing in who they're playing for.
How important in your mind is an antidote for this, if there really is one?
I don't think there's one. I think it's a multifaceted approach. If you're asking me, do I think it's going to get better? I continue to do what I do because I hope it will.
Mm-hmm.
I think the world of sport is symbolic for the rest of America, because it's the only place where, when that team gathers in the huddle, I can't think of any other place in our society where it doesn't matter if you are white or black or Latino or Asian American or Arab American, whether you're Protestant, Catholic, Buddhist, Sikh, Jew, Hindu, Muslim, gay or straight, come from a rich family or poor family, a team can't win if you don't pull together as a team. If we take that spirit into our front offices, into corporate America, into higher education in America, into faith-based America, what a different place this would be.
Are we close to having no sports in your mind if the coronavirus isn't in check or the racism doesn't be kept in check? Are we close to not having any sports at all?
I don't think that racism would stop sports. I think the coronavirus could.
Okay.
I think people will, you know, try to continue to improve opportunities for equality in sports, but I don't ever see the possibility of sports ending because of racism.
And sports is such a very important part in our society. I'd hate like heck to see it go and not be around here anymore.
I think you have a chorus behind you.
So, Richard, is there anything else we would like to bring up that we haven't talked about as of yet?
No, you had a great series. I mean, I probably am doing 10 interviews a day, and those were the best series of questions that I've been asked in all of them. You did a really good job preparing.
Well, I greatly appreciate that, and in the article that was on ESPN Online is where I got the majority of the stuff I got. So, all right, hey, we greatly appreciate it. When's the next one of these report cards going to come out? Is that going to be a while, or are you going to come up with something else prior to that?
In 2 weeks, we issue the one that compares all the sports together, and then we start again with Major League Baseball.
If there is Major League Baseball this year.
Right. That's a big F, yep.
Okay. Anything else real quick before I let you go?
No. Nice job. Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you, and best of luck to you. And I'm sure we'll be running into you down the line a little further, okay?
I'll look forward to that.
All right, Richard, thanks very much. Take care of yourself. That was the interview we did 2 weeks ago with Richard Lapchick, who is a human rights activist and pioneer for racial equality. Great interview we had with him, and we're going to see what all those facts have come out here. That should be coming out here probably about the next week or two, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. We're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Inside the Huddle, sponsored by your State Farm insurance agent, Susan Casper, and Tony Theofanis.
Life insurance is one of those subjects that make people want to change the subject, rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Susan Casper in Frankfort focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house insurance or life without having to give up college insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on with your family. Call State Farm agent Susan Casper in Frankfort at 765-659-5678 and put the life back in life insurance.
Your free local online newspaper, ClintonCountyDailyNews.com, is your number one resource for information as you need it. Right at your fingertips, we have news, weather, sports, obituaries, the WILO program schedule, over 40,000 community photos, online surveys, community events, and WILO TV archives. Plus, click on the info tab to find out how you can contact your local and state representative. Find out what the buzz is all about. ClintonCountyDailyNews.com.
WILO wants to hear from you. Let us know your opinion by sending us an email. We now have a sound-off page at ClintonCountyDailyNews.com. Just go to the community page and click on Sound Off to submit your opinion. We've made it easy for you to sound off on the local issues important to you. You can also submit by emailing your opinion to newsroom@casperradio.com. Let us know what's on your mind. One more way we're keeping you connected. WILO.
WILO and Casper Media are members of the exclusive International Broadcasters Idea Bank. Casper Media and 99 other broadcasters from around the world come together to trade ideas on how to better serve our communities and our listeners. A member of the International Broadcasters Idea Bank since 1991, Casper Media has hosted the Idea Bank Convention throughout the years. Casper Media and Idea Bank, constantly working to better serve you. Depend on WILO.
Rich is just a really, really, really good guy. The term good egg isn't enough to describe him. He's also certified organic and free range. Rich puts the cap back on everything. The toothpaste, the olive oil, the shampoo, everything. He lets his 10-year-old nephew beat him at virtual tennis, even though he can straight up slay his 10-year-old nephew in virtual tennis. When the toilet paper is running low, Rich replaces the roll on the actual holder, not just on the back of the toilet. Rich is texting and driving. Rich? No. What are you doing, Rich? I was just telling everyone how great you are. Texting and driving makes good people look bad. Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a public service announcement brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Inside the Huddle, sponsored by your State Farm insurance agents, Susan Casper and Tony Theofanis. I'm your host, Ken Hartman. As I said earlier, we just replayed the interview we did last week with Richard Labchick because it was a very good interview, and plus the fact some still very pertinent information came out of that. One more thing we want to get to before we get to our 9:30 guest, who is here, by the way. We talked about college football having a lot of coronavirus situations, as we did Major League Baseball in the first part of the show. Let me just do a little further down the line on college football here. It says that the logistics of how college athletics will resume continue to be worked out. One thing is clear, the loss of the 2020 college football season will be incredibly costly. According to a report from ESPN's Mark Schlebeck and Paula Levine, a canceled college football season would result in a $4 billion, that is billion with a B, loss for college athletics programs across the country. This would add to an already significant toll the coronavirus pandemic has wrought on college athletics, as programs have lost hundreds of millions so far. TCU Athletic Director Jeremiah Donati told ESPN, quote, if there's no college football season, or if there is a football season interrupted or shortened, there will be a massive fallout. He said there'd have to be massive cutbacks. Could the department go on? Sure, but it would look smaller and probably potentially be fewer sports and much less programming. The wheels of progress are slowly turning forward. The NCAA voted to lift the nationwide ban on on-campus activities from June 1st to June 30th, meaning players will soon be able to return to campus for voluntary practices. There won't be any coaches at these practices, and there won't be any mandatory for players. But the move is an important first step to the sport's eventual return. That's one thing we're going to be talking to our next guest about, so we'll just hang on with that. And we're going to take another quick break here. You're listening to Inside the Huddle, sponsored by your State Farm insurance agent, Susan Casper, and Tony Theofanis.